Today's podcast is brought to you by Citizen Path. It's a new way to prepare U.S. immigration forms. It's an online service that makes it easy to prepare and file USCIS applications and petitions. Believe me, as a naturalized citizen, I know the hassle. Citizen Path gives you instant alerts if there's a problem. The service even provides a guarantee, yes, a guarantee that USCIS will approve the form. Citizen Path was designed by immigration attorneys, but it's significantly less expensive than an attorney. And here's the fun part. Immigrantly listeners can use coupon code IMMIGRANTLY to save 15%. You can visit their website at citizenpath.com. Today's episode is brought to you by DB. DB is a Scandinavian brand that makes backpacks and bags to help people on the move stay ready for anything, from the streets to the peaks. DB's gear is travel tested by some of the world's best athletes, adventurers, and creators. As a frequent traveler, I'm always looking for great bags, and DB meets a lot of my needs. We at Immigrantly are teaming up with DB to exclusively offer our listeners, our Immigrantly listeners, 10% off your next purchase by using the code POD10. And I repeat, POD10, or going to the link in our show notes. DB, it's time to move on, time to get going.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. They say Sufis are travelers, while Shias are those who remember. Well, I'm a product of both worlds, basking in the mercy of my creator. I'm in a league of resistance, and my prime target is myself. I resist the inner self like I'm running away from hell. Not running away from battle, but I'm running away from myself. Trying to know myself so I can go to war with my lusts and hell. I've lost many a battle, but I just get back up, charred and battered. Like Logan, I fear love, but my skin still comes out healed and better. I regenerate generational trauma, torturing me like karma, a train of dead bodies crossing the border. I shudder, I wither, but I refuse to be bitter, because I'm above that. I'm above that.
Hey, Immigrantly listeners, what you just heard there was Noori Sirdar reciting his poem, Believer, a reflection on faith and struggle. We'll play the rest at the end of this episode, so stay until the end. But I wanted to give you a little taste of today's interview, which I am so excited to air. I mean, the conviction in Noori's voice, the painting he draws with his words, all of that gave me chills. Our special guest today, as you must have guessed by now, is Noori Sirdar. He is a Muslim poet, filmmaker, podcast co-host of 786 Boulevard. But at a more fundamental level, he stands as a change agent in the intersection of religion and social justice. He's someone bringing creative light to these two themes, or if you will, disciplines. His work is so fascinating, and I cannot wait for you to meet him. So let's get started. So thank you so much for coming on Immigrantly. You and I are both podcasters, among other things, right?
Correct, yeah. I think everyone who's a podcaster is a podcaster amongst other things. Very, very few lucky people are podcasters full-time.
You know what? I am trying to do that. I'm trying to do podcasting full-time. I'm trying to grow this as a platform, more than just a podcast, but it takes a lot of work and effort. But let's 100%. Talk about you. What really inspires me about your work is this unique spiritual and artistic focus that you have, Noori. Like, you've both written and spoken poetry reflecting on the Prophet Muhammad, and also more human themes of suffering, hope, and even social justice. How did you get into this work? I am just curious to know what your journey has been so far.
Sure. So I think, like, you know, so many of us, I've always been quite a spiritual person, I would say. Growing up, you know, my mom, I have vivid memories of my mother taking me to dhikr sessions, you know, dhikr Sufi sessions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my father was a follower of, is a follower of Sheikh Nazim Haggani. So Sufism and I guess generally spirituality was very prevalent in my family. And growing up, I always had this kind of energy, this kind of yearning to look out there and reflect on myself and reflect on my faith. And I think that, you know, like many people, I always wanted a way to express that. I was always looking for a way to let go of this massive energy that I have inside me, which is the energy of, you know, the love of the Prophet and the Ahl Bayt, the love of Islam, the love of God and spirituality. And despite the fact that I grew up, you know, hating poetry, but loving listening to poetry that we have back home, particularly in Arabic and in Urdu, I always wanted to find a way to express myself in that. So being someone who didn't speak Urdu pretty much at all, whose Arabic wasn't very good, I decided to start writing in English. When I first started, my poetry really kind of was specific to the Prophet Muhammad and his family, you know, which is a kind of poetry that's very deeply intertwined in the heritage of Shiism and just generally in Islam as well. And growing up, you know, as I got older, as I started exploring my spirituality and exploring the world, the only way I could kind of knew how to express myself and deal with, you know, what I saw around me, be it the social injustices that we have, the spiritual hunger I had inside me, was through poetry. So essentially, it was less of, you know, a hobby and something I was interested in doing, and it became more of really just something that I felt I had to do in order to express myself and essentially worship God in the way that I know how, which is to write poetry.
That's so fascinating. Now, you've mentioned spirituality, and I see people using terms spirituality and religion interchangeably sometimes. Do you think they are interconnected, they are overlapping, or do you see them as two distinct terms with different specific meanings? Like, is there an all-encompassing word for one's belief system, or how do we distinguish between the two?
That's a very very good question. I think that what I've kind of discovered in my own kind of, you know, journeys and reflections is that everyone's spiritual / religious path is kind of specific to them and their own experiences. So I think that, you know, some people you know, might lean more toward quote-unquote spirituality than quote-unquote organized religion. Me personally, I definitely feel the two are heavily intertwined. You know, I think spirituality is more of a cooler word, if I can say that. People who don't really want to be associated with religion say, "Oh, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual." You know, and I think that that is quite interesting. For me, definitely the two are very, very intertwined. You know, my spirituality is my religion, and my religion is my spirituality. They're so heavily interconnected that you can't really separate the two. And I think that is the same for many people, particularly in the Muslim community, I would say, and especially here in the West. But again, like, the way we approach the two subjects is very dependent on our own kind of experiences and our own kind of journeys as Muslims, as people who are exploring spirituality and trying to connect to either God or Allah or even a sense of higher purpose, something greater than ourselves, right? So that's definitely the way I would kind of perceive it and look at it.
So let's talk about religion in general, specifically organized religion. It's funny to me sometimes because in this more global society and economy where science is at the forefront of a lot of decisions that we take, I've noticed that initially people gravitated towards atheism and, in a way, more practical modes of thought, right? And this is all observational, by the way. I don't have any statistical evidence to prove this. But recently I've seen that there has been this re-emergence of spiritual inquiry. And I wonder if it's because people are looking for answers that cannot be answered in full in this complicated world of ours, right? Science doesn't have all the answers. So for you, what has been the most important and grounding aspect of Islam in that sense? And do you think science and faith are mutually exclusive?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think even if you look Islamically, you know, there is this idea of the fitrah, the idea of the deep inner self. And from my understanding of Islam, all of our fitrahs, regardless of where we're from, are wired the same way, in that we're continuously searching for God, continuously trying to reach back to God. And I think what you're describing, in my own kind of observations, again, like, you know, this is all observational, like you said, is that people are searching for a sense of something higher than themselves. So even atheists, you know, I think looking at atheism, it's still an acceptance of something, of an ideology higher than oneself, right? So, you know, it's not obviously, you know, they're obviously rejecting God, but it's still an acceptance of something higher than oneself. And I think that's what people in our society are really striving toward, especially in the West, which I feel has become and is moving toward, in many ways, a very godless society. So in exchange of, you know, the word Allah or God, people are like, oh, you know, I'm surrendering to a higher purpose, or I'm surrendering to fate, or I'm surrendering to good vibes, positive vibes. You know, I think all of it is really just, in my opinion, the fitrah trying to return to God. And I think people, you know, connect to that in their own kind of ways. For me, like I said, it's all very connected. I do not believe that the worlds of science and religion, and again, I'm not like a scholar or someone who's extremely learned on the topic, but from my own observations and experiences, I do not believe that science and Islam are two things that are at odds with each other. I actually worked on a documentary years ago with a sheikh, a scholar who is actually a scientist as well, and he wrote a paper on various scientific theories and how they have been affirmed in the Quran and in Hadith, which I found very interesting. So I think that, you know, when you really study the two, you can find that they do often complement each other, and they're not really at odds with each other. And I think that if you look at things just generally, if you look at life generally from that perspective, I think it's a very refreshing kind of mindset to have. That it's not a case of one or the other, rather it's a case of, you know, there's a truth in everything, and it's all kind of bouncing off each other and all kind of connecting, you know, to one sense of greater purpose.
I completely agree. And as a practicing Muslim, I believe in science like all the time, right? So when people talk about the dichotomy that exists, or if they are not compatible, it does come as a surprise to me as to why people of faith cannot believe in science. But we see that a lot happening, right? There is a lot of polarization. Do you think that's because religion has been politicized to the point where it's less of a spiritual or individual journey and more of a collective assertion of dominance?
I definitely feel that is the case, you know, for many circles. And again, just a caveat, this is all observational, you know, based on my own experiences. I do believe that, you know, you have that kind of sentiment, and it's not something that's limited to religion. I feel like, you know, tribalism generally is something that we all kind of fall, it's a trap that we all fall into. So whether we're, for example, Sunni or Shia, or we're Muslim against atheist, or Christian against Jewish, you know, we all kind of surrender to our own identities, and we kind of make it a very tribal thing. And I think when you have that kind of mentality, it is very antithetical, and it is very unhelpful. So yes, I would agree with you there. I don't think it's specific to religion. And I think that what happens as a result is that people who are interested in religion, you know, when they see people who claim to represent religion or preach religion acting in a way where there's a sense of superiority complex there, where they're talking down to you as opposed to, you know, talking to you in a brother-to-brother kind of way, which many, you know, folks, unfortunately, who claim to represent religion do. And it's very damaging, I would say, to people who are looking for, who are interested in religion, who are interested in understanding religion. And I think that to really kind of overcome that, what we need to do is accept the fact that we're in a world where all of us are here together, you know, looking for a sense of truth, looking for a sense of beauty and goodness. And I think the sooner we accept that, the sooner we can unite on an understanding, or not even unite, but just appreciate each other's perspectives. I think that if you approach religion or life generally from a perspective of, hey, I'm here to appreciate other people's perspectives, when you have that mentality, it's much more constructive, it's much more refreshing. But when it's a sense of, oh, I have the true religion, and you know, I'm the one who's preaching it, and you have to listen to me, which unfortunately so many people in our society have, and again, it's not limited to religion, but it, you know, it is quite prevalent in religion, in Islamic circles specifically. I think it's very damaging, and it pushes people away.
So here's the thing: I don't believe in preaching religion. Do you think that's blasphemous if I were to say I am nobody to preach religion to anyone else, because my understanding is limited to my own lived experiences, right? Do you think people should not be preaching religion at all? Or if they do, how do they add nuance to it?
I mean, I would argue that we're all preaching what we believe in. You know, we're all preaching religion, but it might not be overt. It might not be, it might not be us standing on the side of the street handing out leaflets about Islam. It might just be the fact that, hey, when you go to the grocery, you're just, you know, you say thank you, you open doors to people, you say hello, how are you? You know, you're interested in people, you ask about your neighbor. I think all these good traits that we have in us and just generally the lifestyles that we live are essentially preaching what we believe in, you know, what we feel like we're associated to, especially I feel as Muslims. There's a really nice hadith by Imam Ja'far Sadiq, which I don't want to misquote, but he says something along the lines of, preach with your character, preach with your good manners. And I feel like that's what's very attractive. So I feel like people approach preaching religion in very different ways. I would definitely agree with you in that, you know, I don't feel like, I'm not the kind of person that would preach religion in a kind of way where, you know, I'll take someone aside and say, hey, you know, this is what I believe, and try to force them to believe what I believe. I'm very much along the lines of thinking of, I have my character, and if people feel that can help them in their life, then great. If they feel it doesn't, then that's completely fine as well. And I'm definitely in a more kind of intrigued mindset these days, where I'm just interested in what people believe, interested in what people, what people's perceptions are other than my own. And I personally find that having that mentality often strengthens my own beliefs. So, you know, recently what I do is I've been traveling a lot, and whenever I go to a different state in America or a different town, I try to reach out to, you know, anyone who might have on my Twitter or on my contacts, who see the world completely different to me, and say, hey, let's meet up, let's have a coffee, let's chat. And what I find is that, you know, I interact with people who see things on a completely different spectrum to me. But I find my own, personally, I find my own faith is strengthened. There's a line that I wrote in one of my poems recently, which is that my religion is internal because my internal is eternal. And the reason I wrote that line is because again, this is a very personal thing, personal to me. Not everyone, you know, will share the same experience. But I found that as I grew older, the less I was overt about my religion. Because I realized that when you were younger, you know, as we all know, when you're young, especially those who are religious might kind of share this kind of experience. When you're young, you know, you're in the playground, the first thing you want to do is be as overt as you can, as expressive as you can about your religion, about your faith.
Yeah.
You want to debate everyone about your faith. You want to tell everyone, hey, I'm a Muslim, this is what I believe. And you realize ultimately, in my own personal journey, for sure, that it's often not coming from a place of spiritualness. It's not coming from a place of goodness. It's coming from a place of insecurity. And I find that also a lot of preachers fall under the same trap, where you're not really preaching, going back to the last question, you're not really preaching from a place of spiritualness and goodness, rather you're preaching from a place of your old kind of unresolved insecurities. And that's very damaging. On the flip side, even though I'm less overt about my religion, personally, I feel like my faith is stronger. You know, I feel like, you know, whatever happens in my life, I'm very accepting of it. You know, I feel like at home, behind closed doors, I worship a lot more than I did when I was very overt about it. So I would definitely agree with you on that. And I feel like, you know, preaching religion or da'wah is a whole conversation in itself. But I do personally think that, you know, just by being good, you know, you're already by default preaching what you believe in, because you're representative of your faith or of your ideology, right?
That's so profound, and that's so important. Nuri, I want to circle back to what you said about meeting other people who may not share your religious ideology. What kind of experience did you have? Is there one experience or one meetup that really stands out to you that you really enjoyed or wasn't pleasant at all?
To be honest with you, I think every meeting, you know, I enjoy. You know, even speaking to you, it's something I'm enjoying right now, just because I feel like, you know, life for me is definitely a journey of growth, and everything that happens, every person I meet is an opportunity for growth, you know, both spiritually and in terms of your own mindset. Just sitting down, Sadia, and having a conversation with someone, having a cup of tea with someone, having a coffee with someone, you're already breaking those boundaries. You know, I heard something really profound from one of our guests on our own podcast, who she's a food reporter, and she was saying, in her own way, to battle racism, what she does is, you know, kind of has food with Islamophobes, and what happens there is that, you know, when you're Islamophobic or you're kind of, you know, anti-Muslim, the real issue is that you haven't met a Muslim, you haven't sat down and broken bread with a Muslim. When you sit face to face with a Muslim, you know, you're automatically breaking those stereotypes in front of you. You're breaking those kind of preconceived those preconceived attitudes that you had toward that demographic. So I think generally that's what I've found. When you meet people, you realize in front of you, it's not, you know, a Twitter profile. It's not someone who you're having a back and forth with online. It's flesh, bone, and spirit. It's 30 plus years of experience and story, just like you have. And I think just that, you know, really opens your mind and helps you appreciate other people and other people's perspectives.
Let's talk about Islam. Both of us are practicing Muslims, but there is this misconception that follows about Islam, which is basically orthodoxy and oppression, which is far from true and ordinary. You and I know this. Religion is extremely multidimensional. And even when you focus on one type of religion, you still have a myriad of beliefs and practices within, right? You and I probably practice Islam very differently. How have you used your platform to add more nuance to Islam specifically? And you've talked about it a little in the beginning, but can you elaborate on it a little more?
Sure. That's a very deep question. What I would say is that, again, I think, you know, when it comes to my art and my poetry, the poetry is essentially a reflection of the self, right? So every poet, or every musician, or every storyteller will always write to what they know, and it's a reflection of who they are. So as I continuously grow on the spiritual journey, as my perspectives grow, my poetry will always continuously reflect that. And I think that I definitely came to a point a few years ago where I was like, you know, okay, what are you offering the wider world? Because my poetry, a lot of it was very specific, and I'm very proud of it. It was very specific to the Shia community. Like I said, you know, the Shia community has a great, beautiful, deep heritage when it comes to poetry about the Ahlul Bayt, about the love of the Ahlul Bayt, about the love of the Prophet, about Ashura and Imam Hussein. And, you know, there's a lot of beautiful history there. But I think the question I asked myself was, okay, you're doing great in this kind of field, dare I call it that, but what are you kind of offering to people who might come across you who aren't Shia, who aren't Muslim even? How are you expressing, you know, your faith and your spirituality and even your love for the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt in a way that they can digest? So personally, that's when I started to branch out, you know, as you said in the beginning, into writing poetry about divine love, about God, about the soul, about just generally social justice issues. And I feel like when it comes to social injustice, it's a way that so many of us can unite, because so many of us are very passionate about social injustice, regardless of where we come from, regardless of what our orientation is or what we believe in. And I feel like that's definitely a big unifying factor. It's a place of, it's a uniting point, essentially, for so many different people of different persuasions and perspectives. And, you know, even that aside, it's something that I myself personally am passionate about. It's something that my religion teaches me to be passionate about. So, you know, what I try to do is write poetry about social injustices, write poetry about, you know, divine love and spirituality and you know, things that people who might not be from my persuasion are also interested in. And essentially what happens there is you reach a sense of common ground. I mean, of course, I'm not just doing it completely because I want to, you know, speak to people who aren't like me. I'm also doing it because I want to, because something inside me that I want to express, right? But I think, you know, just by default, you then invite people to you who aren't, you know, who might not share your beliefs or might not really understand, you know, poetry that I write that's very specific to a certain community.
I want to go back to what you talked about initially, Nuri, growing up. You grew up in London, and being a Muslim, what are your observations on Islamophobia in the UK versus in the US? Are there any stark differences? Because when I think about Europe in general, I feel Europe is a lot more Islamophobic, racist than the US.
It's funny because I think I get that sentiment a lot from my American friends as well. And on this side of the pond, you know, we feel like America is more Islamophobic. I think what it is just that, you know, the news paints always a stark picture. Like, for example, whenever I go to America and people hear I'm from London, like, oh, you must be very cautious about knife crime, right? Because the stabbings there are, you know, there's a lot of stabbings going on there. In my head, I'm like, yeah, but you have big gun crime in America. Does that not affect you? So I think that, you know, perception is a very interesting thing. I would say that Islamophobia here is something that's very more undercover. I think in America, it's much more overt. It's much more obvious. Here in this country, you got to remember that there's so many Muslims. Like, there's so many Muslims in this country. I remember a few years ago, I drove to Leicester, which is a city about an hour and a half north of London. I spent the whole day in Leicester, and I swear to you, I did not see a single white person in the whole city. So the number of Muslims, or I guess South Asian Muslims specifically, in this country, it's a huge number of Muslims. So it's also a very diverse place. So the area that I grew up in, West London, which is close to central London, you hear hundreds of languages being spoken. You see so many different skin colors, so many different religions, so many different perspectives. And that diversity that really, it forces you to appreciate different perspectives to you and understand people who are different to you. So, in that sense, Islamophobia is much less. Personally, I don't think I've ever faced any Islamophobia in this country. I struggle to think of an instance where someone was Islamophobic toward me, at least overtly. In America, I've definitely faced it. Yeah, in America, I've definitely faced it more. But there is obviously a lot of Islamophobia here. I think the UK, much like the rest of Europe, is heading toward more of a right-wing, mentality. And there's certain areas in the UK, I would say, up north, where you might not find many Muslims, where people are very Islamophobic and very racist. So there is Islamophobia. I don't know if it's as prevalent here as it is in the US, but I would say that it's much more, it's much more hidden. It's not very obvious. You hear it, in statements, for example, from our government now and then. Boris Johnson always gets into trouble for the people he says. David Cameron, for example, a few years ago, he casually mentioned that Muslim women are traditionally submissive, so we need to fight that. That was his. That's a very Islamophobic thing to say,
right?
Such
a BS, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So you'll hear it, very subtly in statements that might come out like that, but it's not very over like it is in the US, I would say.
Yeah, he hasn't met my mom. If he did, he would never say that.
I don't think he's met any Muslims. That's probably the issue.
Right. Let's talk about something that's been on my mind. It's been bothering me a lot. The term Islamophobia itself. Now, the way I see it, Islamophobia means fear of Islam, right? But fear is a very irrational sentiment. So when we say somebody is afraid or has fear of Islam, are we not giving them an excuse? Are we not putting onus on victims rather than the perpetrator? Shouldn't there be another term which really manifests itself in the true hatred that we see in people towards Islam?
I definitely agree with you. I think one of my friends actually said today that when we use the term Islamophobia, it sounds like a very cute thing that you might have, like the same way you have a phobia of spiders or a phobia of, small holes or whatever phobias there are. There are a lot of connotations to that. I definitely agree with you. And I think we need to accept the fact that even the framing of our conversations, needs to be readdressed. I mean, going back to the last question, when it comes to Islamophobia in the UK, I actually forgot to mention that, for example, here we have the Prevent program, which is probably one of the most Islamophobic initiatives that any government, at least in the West, has done, where essentially, the whole idea of this program is to, tackle extremism in school. So, for example, I know many Muslim friends who are teachers who say if they see, a child acting a certain way, being a bit more religious, maybe growing his beard or whatever, they usually have to report him to Prevent. That's a very Islamophobic program, right? So I think that even the nature of Islamophobia needs to be looked at for what it is, which is something very systemic. It's not just someone who walks down the street might see a Muslim woman and think, oh, that's a bit weird. That's not what Islamophobia or what we think to be Islamophobia is. That's not about the conversation around, fear, dare I call it, that Muslims should be. I think we should really look at it as something very systemic. Muslim oppression is very systemic. And essentially, racism. Right, I think that's essentially what it is as well. And I think that a lot of the conversations around Muslims that we see on high levels of government are very racist. It's that classic, just replace the word Muslim with Jewish or Christian, and that conversation would never take place, And I think that's the problem.
Talking about children, Nuri, I have two kids. Do you have kids?
I do, yeah, I have one.
So let's talk about that. Now, typically what I have noticed is that our religious trajectory is forged by the family and culture from which we come, right? Sometimes kids will grow in opposition of it or grow with it. Is there a healthy way to raise children religious or spiritual? And where is the line when it comes to allowing them to determine their relationship with religion? Let them be who they are.
It's a very interesting question. I definitely say, as a parent, you know, my son's too young for me to kind of, give you the best answer for that. But I do have conversations with friends who have children who are older.
Mm.
And I think that ultimately, when children reach a certain age, there's only so much you can do. If he wants to be a certain way, you can't really, put a gun to his head and force him to be a certain way. I think that when it comes to preaching religion, every parent wants the best for their child. So even forgetting about religion, you have parents who want their kids, for example, to be doctors or to be in the media or to be, or to embrace their artistic vision or whatever it may be. So every parent wants what's best for their child. And if the parent feels that, let's say, for example, religion or Islam is best for their child, they're obviously naturally going to push them toward that. I think that we need to appreciate that growing up in society, you're always going to be met by different perspectives and especially in our society, a diverse range of religious perspectives, a diverse range of perspectives on life generally.
Hmm.
And I think that, what I would lean toward is teaching him religion, but not obviously forcing anything on him and making religion something beautiful to him. To what extent he accepts that, to what extent he accepts my interpretation of religion, I don't think that's really up to me or to any of us parents, children are very intuitive, and as they grow older, they'll always, rebel and lead toward what they enjoy most. But I think that's probably my perception on that.
I am curious to know what you have planned for the rest of the year, because we've seen the past year of pandemic and social unrest, and there are just so many deep wounds. Do you think all of this will inform the next steps that you take as an artist and as an advocate?
I think it's already happened. And I think for me personally, especially during lockdown, and I think a lot of people would agree, just speaking to different artists and friends and people that I know, lockdown kind of forced all of us to sit down and really sit with ourselves, because life slowed down to such an extent where, I remember going outside and there was nothing there. There was no cars, I'm sure all of us kind of share the same experience, especially you guys in New York. Life slowed down to a degree we've never seen it before. And it forced ourselves to sit with ourselves. It forced ourselves to rethink everything. Personally, I rethought everything during lockdown. I rethought the way I look at life. I rethought the way I look at faith, what I wanted to do with my life. I was employed during lockdown, for example, and I actually quit my job afterwards and became a freelancer, because that's something I've always wanted to do. I've even the way I look at my own art, I think art really flourished after coronavirus, because a lot of us were kind of like trying to deal with, our traumas that we hadn't realized that were there, deal with, looking in our mirror for the first time and seeing for the first time what was looking back at us. I think that in moments of stillness, that's really where you discover yourself. That's really where you discover who you really are. And as in this very fast-paced society that we're living in, everything's constantly on the move. You wake up, go to Starbucks on the way to work, grab the subway, you're at work, you go home, you're tired from work, you watch a bunch of movies to relax, and then you sleep and you wake up and you do the same thing again. Coronavirus stopped all of that, right? So during that kind of lifestyle, we weren't able to think, we weren't able to reflect on ourselves and our lives. After lockdown happened, I was forced to sit with myself, and I was, it was really a blessing for me. Obviously, coronavirus was not an easy experience for any of us. We all lost loved ones, we all lost friends. It was a very scary time, but the blessing that came out of it, really, in my opinion, and definitely for me, was the fact that I was forced to sit with myself and really look at myself and understand who I was. And I think once you really understand who you are, you understand where you're going. One of my favorite sayings from Imam Ali alayhi salam is when he says, he who knows himself knows his Lord. And I love that saying, because you can never really know yourself. You can never really know your Lord, but you're continuously on a journey to understanding yourself. And you're continuously on a journey to understanding your Lord, or, your world, or your greater purpose and where you're going. And I think that experience of just really sitting with myself and, looking at myself, I think we all have that, we all have that kind of same, we all have that same experience. Really taught me to redraw my life and rethink where I was going. So it was definitely, it changed everything, to be honest, not even just art. My art, I would say my art definitely changed a lot and flourished, but everything changed. My life changed, my work changed, family life changed, everything changed. And I think it was all due to having to sit down with yourself and really look at yourself.
Are you scared to go back to what was once normal? Because I am having a lot of social anxiety to go back to that life. And I think a lot of people are feeling that.
I mean, the question is, will we ever go back to that life? I think. I mean, I think that's another question we have to ask ourselves, because whether we like it or not, coronavirus changed everything. I mean, just from the very simple things to, like, for example, everyone working from home now as opposed to working in offices. You know, even though a lot of us are returning to offices and returning to our workspaces, a lot of people are now working from home. What we spend money on has changed. You know, the way we look at the world has changed. So even if we return to the quote unquote normal, you know, I don't feel like anything will really be the same. And if, you know, I would argue that if, you know, going back to the normal, quote unquote, is giving you a sense of, you know, a bit of anxiety, maybe it might be time to look at why that is, and then kind of, you know, maybe restructure your life to a way that suits you, which is, you know, what I'm still doing, but definitely something that I did, because, you know, that is when I was like, hey, I don't actually want to go back to work. You know, I don't actually want to do this. So why am I doing it? You know, and it's a very scary conversation to have with yourself, because you're taking a step into the unknown. You're right. Taking a step into what something you've never experienced before. Even me personally, stepping into freelance life, I've always wanted to, I do videography on the side. I'm a video producer, so I do videography, video editing, stuff like that. I've always wanted to become a freelancer. But the biggest question was, hey, can you actually live without a salary? And, you know, be smart enough to organize your finances in such a way, you know, where you're not certain of what's going to happen in a month or in 2 months, in 3 months, in a year. But I think what coronavirus taught me is, hey, you can never be certain of anything.
That's true.
Because none of us could have been certain, you know, of a pandemic coming and ruining and changing everything. So for me, really, I think it also strengthened my faith a lot in that way, because I was like, you know, tomorrow's never certain. From a very simplistic perspective, I was worried about not having a salary hitting my account every month. I was like, hey, you know what? If you take a step into freelancing, maybe now you can rely on God to pay you, as opposed to, you know, your payroll to pay you every month.
I love it.
So my faith was definitely strengthened in that way, for sure.
Nuri, this was so good. Before we end, where can people find your podcast and where can they find your work? Is there a website they can go to?
Appreciate you, Salvia. Yeah, so our podcast is called 786 Boulevard. It's basically a podcast that centers conversations around art and spirituality. It was a podcast that was actually born out of the coronavirus as well. So that's another thing that came out of the coronavirus. Mm. If they just Google 786 Boulevard, you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts, at 786 Boulevard on Twitter and Instagram. And if they want to find my work, they can just find me online, Instagram and Twitter, at Nuri Sardar, NuriSardar.
Thank you so much, Nuri. This was wonderful.
Sadia, appreciate you. Thank you so much.
And we'll end this interview with Nuri's spoken word. Take a listen.
My inner self is a marhab, and his head I'm looking to shatter, because nothing matters except the mind, and they say it's mind over matter. And when I find that my mind scatters, which occurs too many a time, because without such a mind, I cannot bring myself to write rhymes. I rush to pick up the pieces, frantically trying to figure out where the piece is, taking out my compass and trying to find my bearing. The weight is heavy, but burdens aren't too heavy to bear in this world, because I believe I can handle whatever God decides I'm capable of. Nothing's impossible in my mind. If I can imagine it, I can do it. I can create it. I can seize it, because I'm a vessel of light returning to the fight. 313 Spartans at Badr, assisted by angels of light. My religion is internal, because my internal is eternal. And when everything is reduced to ash, among the ash my spirit shall dwell. My soul and this world are two compounds that don't interact well, but I don't react well. I don't react well. I'm above reaction, because my faith is about action. Call me Walaya in action as I'm unsheathing my sword. I'm Ali crouched and ready to act whenever he is ordered. I'm Ibrahim with a knife to the throat of my son. I'm Icarus, only I fear not of the sun, because I bow to no one. Only God has authority over myself. So I'm a soldier on the front line seeking to find and kill myself, because me and myself are at war. My faith and myself are at war. Such is my faith that it is better than me. In every conceivable way, stronger than anyone I know. It wrestles with devils and pushes them away. And maybe one day, I'll have as much conviction as my faith does. Maybe one day, I'll be as strong as my faith is. Because my faith is my strength, and I'm my own weakness.
So when that veil between worlds is lifted, count me among the believers.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Rabbana atina fid-dunya